The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, the fate of Georgia's most recent version of an abortion ban could now rest in the hands of the Georgia Supreme Court. Tuesday, the court heard oral arguments in a lawsuit challenging the ban. Georgia State Constitutional Law Professor Anthony Michael Christ talks about the challenges brought before the court. And also,
Dr. Ward's response tells us a great deal about his concern for the patient. Or maybe it shows his understanding of how the local police worked. Here's what Dr. Ward said.
I never ask such questions. I'd rather not know.
A conversation about a case from 1958, season 4 of WABE's Buried Truths podcast with Hank Libanoff and researcher and journalist Jacob Bush. Those conversations coming up, but first, today is the day.
Happy 40th day of the legislative session. So good to have everybody here. And I'm waiting on my good rules chairman to recognize the Senator from the 28th for the reading of the journal.
Thank you, and good morning, Mr. President, and happy signy die, day 40.
Yep, it's signy die, as noted by Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones and Senator Matt Brass. Now, over in the State House, the mood was, it was business as usual as Speaker John Burns got the day rolling.
House will come to order. House will come to order. Members, please take your seats. The hour convening having arrived, all members will please take your seats. Mr. Clerk, will you please ring the bell?
Nothing like the Georgia General Assembly, I tell you. As hours tick away, lawmakers will still try to make their final votes on proposed legislation before it heads to Governor Brian Kemp to possibly become law. As of airtime, now there are still several measures for the Georgia House and Senate to consider, including their biggest priority, the budget for the 2024 fiscal year. Of course, by law, it must pass by midnight. Also at stake, changes regarding the HOPE scholarship, changes to the state's medical cannabis oil program, and whether to fund more providers, doctors, and inpatient beds to address the mental health needs of so many Georgians. Yes, there's a lot of uncertainty on this final day of the legislative session. One of the biggest question marks is the fate of a controversial school vouchers bill. It was brought to the House floor last week, only to be tabled without a vote, as we hear from WABE Sam Greenglass.
SB 233 would provide $6,500 annual vouchers for private school tuition or homeschooling expenses. The money would be available to kids enrolled in the 25% lowest achieving Georgia public schools. Vouchers have been a perennial debate in Georgia, but on Monday, Governor Kemp told WSB he wants to get it done.
I'm hopeful that we can get this over the finish line. I think they've really done a good job of legislating. They've also listened to a lot of the critics that are out there and taking some of their suggestions.
A version of the bill has already cleared the Senate, but supporters abandoned a House vote when they didn't have the votes. Republican Jan Jones had just finished telling her colleagues that the government leans on private entities to carry out all kinds of state goals.
The GI Bill, public or private colleges, Head Start, private daycares, WIC, Medicare, Section 8 vouchers. Give them a voucher and let them decide where it's best to go.
Opponents like Democrat Phil Olalie say vouchers siphon funding from public schools since they would lose the funding the state allocates per child.
SB 233 will severely harm these public schools by diverting public funds to private schools, making it harder to recruit and retain teachers, pay for much needed social workers and guidance counselors, among other difficulties.
And on top of the governor's support, one other factor to consider. Vouchers could be used as a bargaining chip on signee die as the House and Senate fight over the budget, mental health reform, and online sports betting. Sam Greenglass, WABE News.
Now, a bill to create a commission in Georgia that could discipline and remove local prosecutors. Well, it awaits the governor's signature as we hear from the other half of our WABE politics team, Raul Bali.
The bill is aimed at prosecutors for personal and professional misconduct, along with prosecutors that Republican lawmakers say are making across-the-board decisions not to prosecute certain crimes, like low-level marijuana possession and abortion. Democratic State Senator Elena Parent says district attorneys have always had tremendous discretion.
And they regularly exercise discretion in classes of cases, from bail to sentencing requests to old, outdated laws that are on our books but routinely not prosecuted now, such as crimes against adultery.
Members of the new Prosecuting Attorneys Qualifications Commission would be named by the governor, lieutenant governor, the House Speaker, and the state Senate. Raul Bali, WABE News.
More bills up for consideration on this final day of the legislative session, whether or not to include anti-Semitism as part of Georgia's hate crimes law. Also, bills focus on sports betting, expanding housing and tenant rights. And here's a big one because you all email me, vehicle booting. Yes, whether or not we should ban booting Hank Klebanoff's vehicle in Georgia. Now, one measure that's already headed to the governor, Frank Hanks in studio with us, one measure that's already headed to the governor and will likely be signed into law, well, Georgia election boards will be barred from directly accepting any grant money to fund the 2024 elections. It was passed this session. So we'll go back to Sam Greenglass to find out what this is all about.
Local election offices are chronically underfunded and have increasingly looked to nonprofits for extra money. SB 222 would require any grant funding be doled out only by the Secretary of State. Here's Republican Representative Houston Gaines.
This is a basic function of our government. We should not be seeing partisan outside interests funneling money into counties of one particular party or another. And that's what this bill simply does.
But Democrats say Republican and Democratic counties alike have used these grants, and they've had no choice. Election offices have limited resources to juggle growing demands like mass voter challenges filed by conspiracy theorists. Representative Syra Draper said local election offices are like rowboats.
The election offices that are being targeted with the voter challenges, someone drilled a hole in the bottom of those boats, okay? You can hardly row because you're in there with your bucket desperately trying to bail out the water. And what are we doing here in the legislature to help that situation? We're severely limiting their options for fixing those leaks and patching those holes.
The bill is expected to get one last Senate sign-off before going to the governor. Sam Greenglass, WABE News.
And in other news, severe storms that can produce hail and tornadoes will hit Georgia more often as global warming continues. That's all according to a new study, as we hear from Emily Jones.
The study looks at supercells, a kind of severe storm that produces damaging wind, large hail, and tornadoes. Most strong to violent tornadoes are associated with supercells. The study used computer simulations to predict what the end of this century will look like with different levels of carbon pollution. It predicts more supercells nationwide, especially in the south. And it projects supercell activity will shift to the east, including more storms in Georgia. The state is expected to get one more supercell every 2 years. The shift could put more people at risk from severe tornadoes, because the areas likely to see more supercells are more densely populated than the traditional tornado alley in Kansas and Oklahoma. Emily Jones, WABE News.
Finally, Georgia could be at risk for a low turnout of the state's famous peaches after colder than usual temperatures in March. But as Christopher Austin reports, damage to another crop could be much more costly for Georgia farmers.
University of Georgia agricultural climatologist Pam Knox says peaches need cold winters and warm springs to bear the most fruit. She says the recent cold snaps have killed many of the tree's blossoms.
I think that probably the loss right now is close to 100% on some orchards, especially in middle Georgia where the temperatures were really the lowest.
But because this past winter was on the warmer side, it could mean that more of the peach blossoms will now come in later in the season, avoiding the freezing temperatures. Blueberries need similar conditions to thrive. However, while the U.S. Department of Agriculture ranks Georgia third for the production of both fruits, blueberries brought in more than $100 million in 2021, peaches around 35. Christopher Alston, WABE News.
Ah, two of my favorites, peaches and blueberries. By the way, folks, I need you all to settle a little bit of a controversy here among our Closer Look team. Should peach cobbler have a bottom crust? Let me know, rose at WABE.org or via social media. Because Daniel, who said I had to ask his mom, and his mother says, my mom is saying no, no bottom crust. So there it is. LaShawn Hudson, yes, cobbler should definitely have a slightly burnt crust. Tiffany, cobblers only have breading on top. Important community issues that we talk about here on Closer Look. Should peach cobbler have a bottom crust? You're listening to Closer Look. We're back in a moment.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And that is perfect for our next segment. Closer Look continues now from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Here's a quote from someone I have a lot of respect for. Quote, "We can't change our history, but we can let it guide us to understanding. Buried truths investigate still relevant stories of injustice, resilience, and racism in the American South," close quote. So let's travel 2.5 hours away, 170 miles south to be exact, of Atlanta. The location is Terrell County, Georgia. The year is 1958. James Brazier, a young black father, is killed.
As Dr. Ward examined James Brazier, he saw blood in James Brazier's ear. And he noted that the prisoner struggled to speak clearly, both signs of brain trauma. But rather than send the patient to the hospital for x-rays that might reveal a skull fracture, Ward decided that he smelled alcohol and concluded that Brazier's speech was slurred because the prisoner was drunk. Here's what Dr. Ward said in a later deposition, portrayed here by an actor.
His gait was not steady. His speech at the time was, well, incoherent, not as you would ordinarily expect. But there was another thing in the general examination. One of the things, the odor of alcohol was fairly strong.
That was from testimony Ward gave about 5 years later. His 31-page deposition contains the words odor of alcohol in 6 places. But I want you to know that a blood sample taken right after Brazier's death, was negative for alcohol. Now, depending on when the blood sample was taken and how it was analyzed, it's possible that any alcohol in Brazier's system was simply no longer present. It's also possible there was no alcohol in his system to begin with. In his deposition, Dr. Ward described Brazier's injuries and was asked, under oath, how the prisoner got hurt. Dr. Ward's response tells us a great deal about his concern for the patient. Or maybe it shows his understanding of how the local police worked. Here's what Dr. Ward said.
I never ask such questions. I'd rather not know.
Joining me now to talk more about Buried Truth Season 4 is Hank Klibanoff. So just bear with me. He is a professor of practice at Emory University, director of the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project at Emory, as well as co-author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book every journalist should have on their shelf. It's called The Race Beat, The Press, The Civil Rights Struggle, and The Awakening of a Nation. In full disclosure, he's a colleague and a friend and a mentor. And we also welcome Jacob Bush, who's worked alongside other Emory undergrad and graduate students on these cold cases as a researcher. He is also a fellow journalist in his first year, right? Okay, as well as currently a general assignment reporter for the Marietta Daily Journal. Jacob, Professor Klimanoff, you get one of those. I'm going to call you Hank.
There you go.
Welcome back to the program. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Rose.
Good Thanks.
To be with you.
I want to go back, Hank, to what I said coming into this segment, which is actually a quote from you, I believe. We can't change our history, but we can let it guide us to understanding. And that's been at the core of what Buried Truths has been all about. And for our listeners who just arrived on the planet, maybe, let's take them, tell them what Buried Truths is all about.
Well, Buried Truths focuses on a time in our past when racial justice was very elusive. Justice for people of certain skin color, black, was very elusive. It was hard to get. There was just a tendency of the white power structure, the white criminal justice system, to want to run their own shop, their own way, and there wasn't a place for black people in that. Mm-hmm. And that pertained to the politics throughout the whole society. And so what we look at are cases of killings. We don't call them murder because no one's been adjudicated guilty, mm-hmm. but being, you know, kind of... So we look at killings, and what we're trying to do is understand whether there's a judgment that history can mm-hmm. render in these cases. With if you gather up all the records, you can look at them all and examine what happened. Can we figure out whether justice was achieved and how come it wasn't?
Is it fair to say that if you are unraveling all this evidence that points to someone being murdered without it being an official, you know, legal determination, that then justice is somehow served?
That justice is, in the end, it's served. Yes, yeah. I think so. I think that it's the best we can get. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the perpetrators are mostly dead. The witnesses are dead, you know, things like that. But it's the best we can get. And it's just a way of it's a different way to study history. Mm-hmm. It's a might be a side door method of studying history. I mean, Jake here was a history major. I'm sure he's had everything from the classical delivery of history and presentation by professors. And then there's this.
And then there's this. And I'm going to get to Jacob in a moment because students – so part of this, you know, you and I are, you're an OG. You're an OOG and I'm an OG. So having this generation work alongside you, it's been so important. Jacob, what has this experience been like working with Buried Truths and Professor Klimanoff here?
Well, it's been incredible. So eye-opening, obviously, learning these new methods of research, maybe methods that we didn't come into college thinking we'd ever really learn or experience. Sitting down, going through FBI files from 50, 60, 70 years ago, that's not something that you really prepare for. But this collaborative environment, really having a professor who's there to support you in your research and not necessarily tell you how to go about it or what exactly to do. It was a really unique way of learning that I don't think any of us expected to experience, but certainly enjoyed and found to be invaluable.
Digging through old files, reading through FBI or you know, police reports the old-fashioned way, I'll get an email, not going to Wikipedia. Don't get me started on that, Hank. What was that experience like? You felt like you were going back in time?
Yeah, it felt like you were doing more than just researching. You were really investigating. You were digging into something. I mean, we're uncovering these buried truths. It really is true to the name. And it leads to different people and different documents and even different places, going down to Terrell County and meeting people where they are, that is not the normal way, I guess you would say, of researching history, but something that I know all of my peers and myself really valued.
Hank, for our listeners, tell them how you all determine, now I imagine all the cases that you're aware of could probably be in, you know, a season for Buried Truths. Mm-hmm. What stands out for you that you say to your producers and to the students, this is the one we gotta mm-hmm. Dig into.
Okay. First of all, I do call it the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project at Emory because I wanted to limit it to Georgia. Mm-hmm. You can spend a lot of time looking at Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, Tennessee. That's a lot of work to get there. Mm-hmm. Here we can examine records in the courthouses and in the Georgia archives. We are looking for cases. I started out with a list about 109 or 110 that was produced by the government under the final years of the George W. Bush administration, and when Alberto Gonzalez was the attorney general and Bob Mueller was the head of the FBI, and they started the FBI Cold Case Initiative. And they started off with a list of about 109 cases. Any of us who study this thing know that there are hundreds and hundreds more. Okay, yeah. Margaret Burnham at Northeastern has put together her group of 1,200 cases, you know, of unpunished racially motivated killings in the South. And they haven't even stopped. They're not anywhere close to being finished. But whatever the number is, and I looked and pulled out the Georgia ones. And frankly, the first one that we did, the first season, was about Isaiah Nixon, who was killed for voting. I did that because it was we were running into the 2016 election. I never knew the 2016 election would itself be so historic. But it you know, became a topic that was pertinent. Voter suppression was pertinent. And ultimately, if you kill somebody for voting, that's the ultimate suppression. We did another one, and the next one was A.C. Hall out of Macon, because he was a young 17-year-old kid who was shot and killed by two white police officers, shot in the back while he ran. Then we did, and this Jake worked with me on the one, the current season, James Brazier and Willie Countryman, but I taught that seven times before I finally said, okay, I think we're ready to do a podcast, okay? And in the interim, we worked together on the Ahmaud Arbery case, which is not a modern civil rights era, but we thought it was so resonant of those cases that we had to look at it.
Absolutely. Let's go to 1950s, Terrell County, Georgia. Tell us just what's happening. What's all this about?
Well, it's a farming community, very, you know, supported very much by peanuts. And a poor community. It's majority black, you know, almost two-thirds black. Produced a couple of very famous people. Otis Redding,
of course,
came out of there, was there for 2 years before he moved to Macon. And anyone who goes to Washington, D.C. and walks around, they'll come across the Walter Washington Convention Center that just goes block after block after block. And he was the first African-American mayor of Washington, D.C. He came out of there. But it was a white-run town, and back in those days in the 50s. And they had some of the meanest, most white supremacist law enforcement of any town I've seen, and the county as well, Terrell County and then the town of Dawson. Very mean, spiteful law enforcement leadership.
Tell our listeners about James Brazier. What type of young man was he?
Well, he was 31 years old. He was married to a woman, Hattie Bell Brazier. They had four children. They they worked hard. He had three jobs. She had two jobs. And frankly, they had good money. They made more. We know how much they made. This came up in court records later, and plus just other things that we were able to put together. And in fact, he did make more money than the policemen who ended up being the people who came after him. He, like a lot of young men, 31 years old, 1958, fell in love with the brand new Chevrolet that had just come on the market, the Chevrolet Impala.
Yeah.
And he loved it, and he wanted it, and he could afford it. And he worked at the Chevy dealership also, doing whatever they would let a black man do in 1958, you know. And sure enough, he got him a car, and he had earlier owned a 1956 that he gave his father. And so these two men are driving in nice cars, and the police did not cotton to that. They didn't like it one bit, and they would stop him so many times. And we can find in the records that one of our students, colleagues, found time and time again that black men would have to show up in the mayor's court and have to pay fines. And to a large extent, it was the black people paying fines that was supporting the city government. It was just that kind of a place.
So the police, they didn't like it.
No, they didn't like it. They were jealous.
I want to play a clip from episode 2, when the police come for James Brazier.
Early on a Sunday evening in April 1958, after a full day in one church and then another, James Brazier's entire family, his wife and four children, and about a dozen neighbors, were outside their homes watching as a Dawson police car jolted to a stop. T.
Two officers got out and, with his family standing in the front yard, placed James Brazier under arrest. As they took him to the squad car, he wanted to know why they were messing with him. At this point, the police claimed, Brazier started resisting, and the beating began. Lucius Holloway was one of the neighbors watching from his porch across the street.
He was just screaming. He could hear him screaming. It looked like back to Atlanta, and they was hitting too. Whomp, 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 just hitting everywhere. And he was just waving his arm about, trying to dodge, and he just fell, and he was rolling, and he was screaming, I ain't done nothing, I ain't done nothing, I ain't done nothing.
This is James Brazier's daughter, Verda, who watched all this through her six-year-old eyes.
It was a horrible thing to see, I tell you that, a horrible sight. And you couldn't do anything. Just watching your mom scream was enough to drive you crazy.
Yeah.
And we just chilled and just couldn't do nothing. Everybody standing around looking. Nobody could do anything.
6 years old.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And doesn't not think of it every single day of her life. You know, I talk to them quite frequently. It's constantly on their minds. And it had a... What happened that day when the police came onto the lawn and tried to stop him was pretty horrifying to the 10-year-old son of James Brazier, James Jr. And he went and tried to save his father from the policeman. He didn't know what was happening. His policemen were dragging his father across the lawn through a ditch. And so he throws his arms around the policeman's legs. Quit hitting my daddy. Quit hitting my daddy. And the policeman knocked him down. And it was pretty horrifying. And it changed James Jr.'s life right then and there. Forever, his family will tell you. He became an angry, angry man.
I want to shift now to you becoming a professor and a teacher because your students are watching you conduct these interviews sometimes. I'm imagining. Are you also teaching them or giving them points and suggestions and tips that when you are interviewing someone and you, and this, look, this is trauma. Mm-hmm. And you're asking folks to recall something like this, particularly because some folks are alive.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to ask you what you're telling them. I'm going to ask Jacob, what are you picking up from Hank?
Well, a lot of it is to listen, just let people talk. That was the biggest thing I learned is that as long as you show a willingness to listen and that you're there to really hear their story, that's your goal. That they're gonna talk to you and share with you things that are really personal, very traumatic, very hard to bring up, but important and necessary. And they know that that's the work that you're doing. That's why you're here, is to bring out the truth and to hear what they have to say and what they've experienced.
Is that what you're teaching, Hank?
Yeah, I would say that's pretty good. That's he got it.
He got it. I don't want to give too much away because we want our listeners to download this and listen to it. You talked to family of the officers, were you able to? And mm-hmm. What were those conversations like?
Mm-hmm. I have to say that's one of the highlights of this whole experience, this whole season, was a letter that I received from the granddaughter of Wayman, police officer Wayman B. Cherry. And Wayman Cherry is the one who, you know, was so horrible to James Brazier and jailed him that night, and then came out in the middle of the night and with another police officer, dragged him out of his jail, and a couple of hours later, brought him back in, threw him back in the jail, and he was all but dead by that time. And the granddaughter knew none of this, until she read our website. Her sister did, and then told her, and she was just devastated. She didn't know her grandfather because he had died before she got to know him. Her own father was only, I think, 16 when he died, okay, and when the father died.
I want to play a clip.
Yeah, good.
Okay.
My father and McDonald were trying to push him, they were taking him away and pushed him away, pushed the son away from his father. And they said he was just an angry, angry man for the rest of his life, you know.
Oh, sorry, that breaks my heart.
I'm sorry. I have to remember who I'm talking with.
No. Please, no. Please don't apologize. I mean, it's the truth of what happened. And picturing, you know, what I had read and the way that they just, you know, in his front lawn in front of his family, in front of his children. And, you know, I think about as a mom and my children, and, you know, it's just so heartbreaking.
She, by the way, her son, her oldest son, was 10 at the time that she came to this recognition that the scene that she was reading about on the website was about James Brazier Jr. when he was 10 and coming to his father's rescue. And by the way, if I might step back one moment, this whole day began when James Brazier's driving through town. They've all been to church, and he sees police have stopped his father, Odell Brazier, who's driving the 56 Chevrolet, and they're beating up his father trying to get him into the police car. And James Brazier goes up and says, "Don't hit my daddy. I'll help you get him in the car." Of course, all the policeman hears is the imperative, "Don't hit my daddy." Mm-hmm. What you've got is, on one Sunday afternoon, within an hour's time, three generations of Braziers who have come into conflict with the police because they're trying to protect their own fathers.
What was the official cause of death? Which is, I want folks to, when they get into the podcast, this is interesting too, but what was the official cause of death?
Oh, it was head injuries from blunt trauma, and they found a 9-inch crack in his skull, and, you know, it was pretty clear he'd been beaten up bad.
No charges?
No charges. There were never any criminal charges. You'd have to ask law enforcement to investigate itself. The feds were starting to get interested without getting too wonkish about the government piece of it, but the 1957 Civil Rights Act had just passed and had created the Civil Rights Division, and they were putting pressure on the FBI to go where J. Edgar Hoover didn't want them to go, his agents to go, into the South, taking up these local causes. They would say that's a state matter, but the Civil Rights Division was pushing for this, and they did impanel a grand jury down in Macon, the federal grand jury, and nothing came of that. And one of the reasons is because one of the witnesses who was in the jail that night and who was going to go testify before the grand jury, he is walking through Dawson a few days earlier before the grand jury, and policeman Cherry, the same guy we were talking about, sees him on the street and says, "What are you doing here?" And he knows that this man is going to testify at the grand jury against him. And he says, "I'm just in town doing something, buying groceries." And he says, "Well, you don't need to be out here. You need to come with me." And he locks him up for the duration of the grand jury. So he didn't get a chance to testify.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that policeman, I don't know if we'll have sound on this or not, but Marvin Gaucher was the witness, and he ends up, according to his death certificate, dying quite mysteriously.
Really?
And Jake broke this for us. He found the truth behind this case.
Jake, I'll let you take it from here. What'd you find?
Yeah, in 1961, I think it was March 1961, Marvin Gaucher dies under mysterious circumstances. They say he dies of asphyxiation in a funeral home, a local funeral home. That was just the knowledge that we had going into it. And I did some digging. I found his sister, and I called her up, and lo and behold, his family does not believe that was the case, that he was killed by the police or someone else who didn't want him to be able to share the truth about what happened to James Brazier that night.
Jacob, I have a question from a listener who wants to know, how much of the census do you all need to dig into to find research and to find relatives? Is the census a big part of this?
Definitely. We used Ancestry. We had access to it through Emory to dig up files, personal records, birth certificates, death certificates as well. We're very helpful in this. That's how we found out some of the inconsistencies about Gaucher's death, also about James Brazier's death. And that was very important to us. These sources that maybe aren't so kind of usual for this kind of researcher that we wouldn't expect to use, but that were very helpful.
Hank, often you have community forums, and you have something coming up in May. And what do folks want to know most? What are those questions you always get in doing this, not just a podcast, but just in all the work that you've done around, whether cold cases, civil rights cases? What do folks want to know?
It's several things. One is sort of personal. Why do you want to do this? Mm-hmm. particularly why do you, as a white guy, want to do this? I'll think of an answer before my time is up. No, the answer, I mean, it goes to just, it's a combination of things. I was a journalist for many years. I'm curious.
That's what we do.
That's right. That's what we do. We always want to finish the story, right? And there's also the social justice piece because it is the last chance to get justice in these cases, you know. So that's part of it. The other part is what they ask the people themselves. So this at this May 2nd event we're going to have, the Bury Truth Live, that there'll be more announcements coming out on. We will have some of the principals who come, you know, who are part of this season. We did it after Bury Truth, the first season when we brought Dorothy Nixon Williams. My goodness, she got a standing ovation from people for a room of 400 people. And these are people who've only ever heard her through their phone, I mean, through their earbuds. You know, that's amazing.
And what does it mean to the families of the victims?
They don't know at first what it's going to mean. Sometimes they're not sure if they can trust us. They don't know if are we just trying to make some money off them. You know, I don't find that an inappropriate question.
Sure.
And I think they are learning. I talked to James Brazier's daughter today, one of his daughters, Hattie, and she had been listening to the podcast. She says, there's so much we didn't know. So much we didn't know. And you're answering questions that we've had for a long time.
By the way, it is May 2nd, I believe, at First Baptist Church of Decatur.
Right.
Bury Truth Live, 6:30 p.m. We'll have more information.
You do have to register to get in.
You do have to register because Hank may not let you in. Hope I can get in. Jake, I'm going to give you the last word. What has it meant to you to work on something like this?
I tell everyone who asks and who's interested that this is the most important work I did in college, the most important research I've done so far, certainly the most impactful for me personally. It's just extremely powerful to hear these stories, to dig into them, and to most importantly bring a sense of justice and closure for the families.
We need more folks like you. Welcome to the club.
Thank you.
Jacob Bush, Hank Klibanoff, thank you all so much for taking the time. Really appreciate it. Bury Truth, Season 4, out now. Available where you get your favorite podcast. It's like a commercial. We're back in a moment. Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Tuesday, Georgia Supreme Court heard oral arguments regarding Georgia's Living Infants Fairness and Equality Act, called the LIFE Act, and it bans most abortions about 6 weeks of pregnancy. Now, the state bases that on cardiac activity being detected. So it's the state of Georgia versus Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Justice Coalition. So on behalf of the coalition, which includes abortion rights groups and physicians, they say the ban violates the state's constitution because it passed in 2019 when Roe v. Wade protected abortion access. Now, the attorney general's office argues that since Roe is now overturned, it shouldn't retroactively invalidate Georgia's abortion law, and it should remain. The court is expected to give its ruling by July. But until then, let's welcome back Anthony Michael Christ to the program, Georgia State University professor of law, whose focus includes constitutional law. Professor, as always, thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Let's begin with this and jump right into it, because what's being argued, and I want folks to listen to this exchange between Justice Bethel and Solicitor Stephen Petrani.
It doesn't make any difference in this case, because in this case, we're arguing you should be applying a federal decision retroactively, not that you should come up with some sort of exception to it.
You've made this point a couple of times, and I want to make sure that I understand the state's argument here clearly. This notion that you apply the federal rule retroactively is independent from our state constitution's direction that that which violates the state or federal constitution, regardless of the federal interpretation that may come later, that's in our state constitution. So that's a state rule. This whole doctrine is not predicated on what the federal rule about retroactivity is. It's only in our constitution, right?
If you're referring to the rule that unconstitutional statutes are, you know, well, statutes in violation of the U.S. Constitution or the state constitution are void. Yes, that's in the Georgia state constitution. Yes.
Okay. So, Professor, if you want to, I need you to delegalize that for our listeners. What is the state arguing here?
So the Georgia Constitution has a provision that says once a statute is deemed unconstitutional, it is void. It is unenforceable, and it never was lawful. And essentially what that means is that we don't want legislators to be able to either retroactively make an unconstitutional law constitutional, or to try to just amend the law to make it constitutional on the back end. So we want the rules that are enforced to be enforced and good and not have a kind of a confusing state where we're trying to retroactively make rules that were impermissible justifiable by later action. And it's really just a matter of keeping things simple and making sure that everybody knows what their responsibilities and obligations are under the law and not trying to retroactively make new rules as we see fit.
Now, here's Julia Stone on behalf of Sister Song.
Retroactivity is a question of when there is a change of the law or a change, a new judicial doctrine pronounced, whether that case law has retroactive effect. And this ties...
So that would apply, retroactivity would apply to the piece of this analysis as between Dobbs and Roe and Casey.
It wouldn't apply to this analysis. It applies to federal claims. And there's no...
Is Roe a federal case?
Roe is absolutely a federal claim.
So why would Dobbs, being applied retroactively, not have an effect on whether Roe is still good law?
Dobbs has a retroactive effect when the claim at issue in a lawsuit is a federal claim. It's what we saw in the federal lawsuit that many of the same plaintiffs brought.
And we should note that was Justice Sarah Hawkins Warren there with Attorney Stone. Break this down for our listeners, what Stone was trying to say here.
So the argument here is that because when the General Assembly passed the abortion law in 2019, it violated the precedent that was on the books, that Roe was good law and that there was a fundamental right to an abortion. But the Supreme Court in Dobbs said that that was never a correct decision. And so there's this kind of philosophical argument about what really was the law in 2019. Was it Roe or was it something else?
So a philosophical argument, how do you decide on that? That's a...
Yeah. So that's the real challenge for the justices here, because the art of law is line drawing and creating rules that are easily applied in a variety of situations. And that's not really the case that we have here, right? I think what we really don't want in Georgia constitutional law is a doctrine that says that you can resurrect laws that were once deemed unconstitutional many, many, many years later without having the General Assembly needing to reconsider them, right? So trigger laws and things like that. Mm-hmm. But you also don't want a scenario where the General Assembly can't test constitutional rules either, right? So in this case, it's abortion, right? The General Assembly was testing whether Roe was good law. But you could see a future General Assembly wanting to test gun rights, mm-hmm. and the ability to enforce greater gun control laws, right, if Democrats took control of the General Assembly. So this kind of testing can go both ways.
So are there cases out there with a similar angle, maybe in context, that might help give greater context to this one?
Yeah, there's a few in Georgia history that I think are helpful. I think perhaps the most useful one is that Georgia had a statute that basically governed commerce, and it's, you know, tricky in the details, but the federal government passed a law later that preempted Georgia's statute, and therefore Georgia's law was void. Later on, the federal government repealed certain actions and would have let Georgia regulate what they originally wanted to do anyway. And the Georgia Supreme Court said, no, 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 that law was dead for a good amount of time. You can't just kind of resurrect a zombie law out of nowhere, you have to go back through the political process and do it again. Mm-hmm. There's a political accountability aspect to this. And what we don't want is a situation like in Wisconsin, for example, where an abortion law was on the books that was 100 years old that was invalidated. And then all of a sudden, because of the Dobbs decision, the attorney general wanted to resurrect this 100-year law out of nowhere. That's a very different situation than what we have in the Georgia bill, where we were in ongoing litigation at the time that Dobbs was being decided.
So there are a lot of what ifs and scenarios and what sort of precedent this could set for state lawmakers. And should the state Supreme Court rule in favor of the state, that's one aspect of it. And if the court rules in favor of the pro-abortion rights group, does this mean lawmakers can just come back around to write and pass the law or another version with more mandates or provisions again?
Yeah, I think the ultimate takeaway that people should understand from this element of the litigation is that no matter what, we're going to come back to the Georgia Supreme Court again, either on appeal from whether deciding a state constitutional right to abortion attaches and the 2019 law is unconstitutional as a consequence of that, or whether they void the 2019 law, the General Assembly comes back and passes a new law. And then we have the same question again, is there a fundamental right to abortion under the Georgia Constitution? So this in many ways is an interim question, and it's not really speaking to the fundamental abortion right at all. This is about the political process in Georgia and the confines of the Georgia Constitution imposes on the General Assembly.
What do you want folks to know about how often state constitutions can either, often they may predate a Supreme Court or what have you, but is it often that a state constitution can, for lack of a better word, trump a Supreme Court decision?
Well, in many cases, the federal Supreme Court says that there isn't necessarily an affirmative obligation on the states to provide certain things or to recognize certain rights. It doesn't preclude the state from doing so. And so whether it's an abortion or the right to an education or even the right to same-sex marriage in the early 2000s, state Supreme Courts and state constitutions can afford more protections than the federal constitution. They just can't provide less.
In overturning Roe v. Wade, and let our listeners know, inform them what the justices did determine in terms of this going back to states for litigation in terms of other challenges. What did they say in the ruling?
Well, in the Dobbs decision, a majority of the Supreme Court said that because there is no express right to an abortion in the Constitution's text, and because they said there was no history or tradition of protecting abortion rights in the United States, that this was an issue that was not a fundamental right under the federal constitution, but it was a state issue. And therefore, state legislatures can make decisions, but state legislatures can make decisions on abortion policy to the extent that they're not constrained or limited by their own state constitutions. And so that's the question that we now have in Georgia. Not only what does the General Assembly want to do as a matter of policy, but what, if any, limitations does the Georgia Constitution provide in terms of making sure that women have an access or a right to reproductive health care.
Might this be a situation where the justices are unable to determine a ruling of sorts and need more information or bring in a separate, you know, like we had with the water wars, we had to bring in some type of water czar or something like the czar. So might the justices say, look, we need to take a different route before we actually rule? What's the likely outcome of that happening?
Well, I think the most likely outcome, given what I saw in the courtroom yesterday, is that the Superior Court in Fulton County is going to have to address the real core question that everybody in Georgia wants to know, right? Not this procedural question, but whether or not there's a fundamental right to abortion access under the Georgia Constitution. And the judges and the justices who are dealing with this question are going to have to look at the text of the Georgia Constitution. They're going to have to look at the precedent and the evolution of the right to privacy under the Georgia Constitution, which has been in place since 1905. Mm-hmm. And they're going to have to talk to historians and law professors and folks like myself, right, who've studied this question and can maybe shed some light on the history and tradition of reproductive health care access or abortion in Georgia law and what that might mean in terms of interpreting the Georgia state constitution.
Meanwhile, could they issue some other type of stay or injunction or anything to delay the law or have you halt the law while they're trying to figure this all out?
I think that's very unlikely. I suspect what we will see is that the Georgia Supreme Court will say that there was nothing impermissible about the General Assembly wanting to test a constitutional rule in this way, and that the ACLU's case has not been met here. However, again, that just means that they will have to return this question back to the trial level and have Judge McBurney or somebody else eventually decide that fundamental rights question, which then they in turn will have to decide themselves. And that'll bring this case to some finality, unless they strike it down, in which case the General Assembly would have to come back and provide a new law that comports with the mandates of the Georgia Constitution.
So we all wait. Anthony Michael Christ is an assistant professor of law at Georgia State University. As always, we appreciate you taking the time and explaining both sides of this to our listeners. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Raizel. Tiffany Griffin is our supervising producer. Our engineer is Sawyer Vanderwerth. A reminder, let us know your thoughts on today's program or any other. You can send me an email, because y'all love to, rose@wabe.org. And if you missed any of today's program, it's online, wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m., as well as in our podcast. So subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like. And stay tuned to 90.1 WABE. Coming out of Atlanta, I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.